Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the growing public outrage over the standoff between the two corporate giants Time Warner Cable and CBS, who in the last 12 months earned $7.65 billion and $3.65 billion in profits respectively. Susan Crawford, who served as Special Assistant to President Obama for Science, Technology and Innovation Policy and is the author of Captive Audience, The Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age, joins us. We will discuss what recourse customers who have been denied service they are paying for have, given the passivity of the FCC and the absence of a Congress more beholden to contributors than constituents. Then we'll examine the irony that one of the lies Bush-Cheney sold to get us into the Iraq War, their claim that al-Qaeda was setting up bases in Iraq, is now becoming a grim truth as al-Qaeda in Iraq's Sunni resurgence against Maliki's corrupt and sectarian government gains momentum. Peter Van Buren, a 24-year veteran State Department official who served in Iraq and is author of We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People, joins us to look into the fragmentation of a country the Bush administration liberated that is now dominated by Iran. Then finally, we will speak with an expert on drugs in sports, Dr. Gary Wadler, a physician and chairman of the World Anti-Doping Agency's Prohibited List and Methods Subcommittee. We will discuss today's suspension of 13 baseball players, including three-time American League MVP Alex Rodriguez, who will be sidelined for 211 games through the 2014 season. We'll also discuss the problem that won't go away and what can be done to clean up sports. Joining us now is Susan Crawford, who's a professor of law at the Benjamin Cardoza School of Law at Yeshiva University and a regular contributor to Bloomberg View and Wired. She served as special assistant to President Obama for Science, Technology and Innovation Policy and co-led the FCC transition team between the Bush and Obama administrations. Susan Crawford is a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, where she leads the Institute's work on making high-speed internet access a universal, affordable resource for all, and is a member of Mayor Michael Bloomberg's Advisory Council on Technology and Innovation. Professor Crawford has been a visiting professor at Harvard, Yale, and the University of Michigan, and his latest book is Captive Audience, The Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age. Welcome to Background Briefing, Susan Crawford.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
And these two corporate giants, Time Warner Cable and CBS, having their private spat at the expense of the public, it would seem. It's over the retransmission consent fees, which Congress authorized. Apparently, CBS is asking for an increase from Time Warner of doubling from $1 per subscriber to $2 per subscriber. And by comparison, ESPN commands more than 5% per subscriber. So I guess, is this a plague on both of the houses? I mean, I don't think the public cares one way or the other, do they?
Well, because so many Americans rely on programming coming over a wire into their home, there is some, that's what this uproar is coming from. They do care that they're losing access to programming. They probably don't care which one of these giants succeeds in this fight. I mean, as you said, this was all set up by a statute 20 years ago, and both companies are acting rationally. It's just that they have no particular incentive to be reasonable in this context.
But they don't appear to care too much about the consumer, in the sense that they're having a kind of corporate battle, and they're doing what you expect of these sort of corporate lawyers, etc. You know, they're going to the mat and doing all of those macho things that they are trained to do. But it seems like they're in a different universe from the audience, who are actually paying for this subscription service to Time Warner Cable, and they're not offering any refunds. I mean, so here we are, millions of us, I'm included, not getting what we paid for, and we don't seem to have any recourse.
Well, what's useful about this is that it sheds light on the real power of the cable distributor when it comes to all information. So exchange for CBS, just think news, information, data, anything coming over that wire into your home is now under the control of Time Warner Cable. And CBS knows that and wants to get as much of Time Warner Cable's revenues as it can, and so is engaging in a game of chicken. Now, usually these games of chicken don't go all the way over the wire and don't result in consumers losing their signals. But in this instance, CBS has no incentive to act any differently. You could get access to their programming just by using a pair of rabbit ears and getting it over the air, but fewer and fewer Americans take advantage of that. Less than 10% of Americans get over-the-air television. So more and more of us are stuck with these extremely expensive bundles of channels, and we're not allowed to choose which channels we'd like to buy one at a time. And in turn, the programmers, the broadcasters, have no incentive to make their programming just available online so that we could watch it over an internet connection. And in any case, the cable distributor would charge us for the internet connection. So you're right, these guys do extremely well, and it's the consumer who gets squeezed, and it's useful to shed light on the enormous concentration of market power that exists in this marketplace.
So then this could be really an object lesson for those who don't recognize the importance of what's called net neutrality, which is a very insufficient term to describe the preservation of the electronic commons. And if you had total corporate control of the internet, which I believe is up for grabs now in the D.C. Circuit Court, is it not? These appointments of these judges that the Republicans have thwarted are very key to the case where the big companies, including Time Warner, are trying to take away the Jenikowski rules to enable these big corporate monopolies to basically control what you get over their wires, and they'll fast track what they want to sell you, and what you want gets put on the back burner. This should be a real wake up call in that context, shouldn't it?
I think it's useful. At first, I was going to respond, no, one of these issues is about cable programming, one is about the internet. But you're right to step back and say it's just one big digital pipe. And Time Warner Cable and Verizon will say, we are just like the Wall Street Journal. We're just like the New York Times. We're an editor, and we are private actors subject to absolutely no control. And if you try to tell us what to do over these wires, we'll tell you it's unconstitutional. It's against the First Amendment to have any amendment, any regulation of us. That's what's at issue here, is that these giant players who really are subject to no competition and are able to steadily increase prices on consumers every 6 months or so and are able to control flows of information are now very baldly claiming that any regulation of them is presumptively unconstitutional, and I hope people are paying attention to that.
And that comes up in the fall, does it not? And it's soon before this D.C. Court of Appeals that is short a number of judges and has been for some time and isn't totally dominated by Republican appointees.
Yes. This is a very important case, Verizon against FCC, that will be argued on September 9th. And it's facially about whether or not the net neutrality rules adopted by the Federal Communications Commission in December 2010 we're done with any statutory authority, but it's actually a broadside attack on the ability of Congress or the FCC to say anything to these guys, because the argument is, again, that these giant communications companies are just like newspapers, that they're private, they reserve the right to edit, and any government control of their ability to do that amounts to, in their world, censorship. So there's a very powerful, very broad arguments being made. And as in the healthcare battle, these arguments sound initially just absurd. But if you keep saying it over and over and over again, it gets to the Supreme Court, and we risk losing the ability to constrain what are essentially monopoly providers of communications all over America.
Again, I'm speaking with Susan Crawford, who's a professor of law at the Benjamin Cardozo School of Law at Yeshiva University, and she served as a special assistant to President Obama for Science, Technology and Innovation Policy, and is the author of Captive Audience, The Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age. So nowhere in the discussion that you just pointed out of what's at stake here does the consumer who are the advocates for the consumers and citizens here? I mean, the FCC rules that this lawsuit would overturn, are they absent here? I know the Congress has recessed. I'm not sure that they're entirely loyal to the consumer so much as their contributors. And aren't these big telecom companies among the biggest lobbyists in Washington?
Yes, AT&T gives more money to Washington than any other actor, including Goldman Sachs. Well, there's a statute that says that broadcasters can charge for their programming, and that's what's going on in the CBS Time Warner Cable dispute. It's unlikely that the FCC will jump in here and fix the CBS problem because they don't believe they have authority to do anything about it. What's very likely is that the lobbyists for the telecommunication companies will continue rolling on smoothly as they have for some time with very little public uproar. So for my purposes, the fact that people are suddenly paying attention to the CBS issue allows us to draw back the frame and say, look how much power these guys have and how little concern they have for the free flow of information over their wires. And in fact, we've deregulated the entire sector of wired transmission of information to people's homes, and particularly the cable providers are subject to almost no competition across America when it comes to very high speed, low latency communications. So they can do whatever they want. So we've gotten ourselves back in the era of Standard Oil and the railroads with very little oversight of what is essentially an input into absolutely everything we do. Now it's communications. It used to be oil.
Well, Susan Crawford, over the weekend, in wanting to watch 60 Minutes and other programs on Sunday, I was on the phone for a couple of hours, you know, on hold from Time Warner Cable, saying I'm either going to, you know, quit this service or you're going to give me a discount since you're not providing me with the service that I'm paying for. And they were completely unresponsive. And the problem I had was that if I cut them off, I lose my internet because I'm bundled on the internet with both internet and television. And I imagine an awful lot of Americans are too.
Right. And you don't really have anywhere to go. I mean, it's unlikely that you have an independent fiber provider in your neighborhood. So the bottom line is we're paying 10 times what people are in other countries for services that are a tenth as good. We get very little upload, so we can't do our business in the cloud. We're subject to these extraordinarily high programming costs. And the entire apparatus is set up to charge consumers more and more. We're actually getting second-class service for an enormous rate. So they're not going to give you a discount. Their view is that you paid for the bundle, and it's up to them, because they're the New York Times, what's in the bundle. And if you quit, you don't have anywhere else to go. So they've got you in a perfect headlock. Now you can go off and just buy a pair of rabbit ears and watch CBS, but that won't give you the internet access that you need to run your business from your home or, you know, get access to telemedicine or education or all the other things you need to be able to do. And even that internet access that you're able to buy from Time Warner Cable is much more extensive and much greatly inferior in quality to what you can get in other countries. So I hope that people really light up and pay attention to this set of issues because it's all going south at the moment.
And there was an op-ed recently in the New York Times in response to your book, which I was surprised to see from an executive at Verizon who complained about your book. And I was astounded because my understanding is that the previous CEO of Verizon actually was a forward-thinking executive who championed Fios, this fiber optic system, and they started to lay fiber optics and give their consumers the kind of high speed that you have in Japan and in South Korea and other countries. And Wall Street decided that it was going to take three years to recoup on this, and that was too long for Wall Street. So they pressured Verizon, and they fired this guy, and then they replaced him with a guy who's much more compatible with Wall Street's short-term thinking.
Right. Well, the bottom line for America is that it, as far as Internet access is concerned, we truly live in a backwater. And yet it's in Verizon's interest and Comcast's interest and Time Warner Cable's interest not to have Americans realize this. They would like to keep the status quo in place. They're making enormous profits, and they've divided up markets between themselves. So Verizon, as you say, has backed off almost entirely from installing Fios. They haven't expanded and won't expand those areas beyond what they promised in March 2010. So 18 million Americans at most will have access to Fios, and it, by the way, is very expensive anyway. But they're not going any further with that. They've gone almost entirely into wireless access, where they're still making pretty high profits. And Verizon is cooperating with Comcast and Time Warner Cable in a joint marketing arrangement. They're not competing with each other. So it is absolutely in their interest to keep this very smooth facade of communications in place in America and not have Americans realize that we are a backwater. We're becoming a third world nation, especially in comparison to Asia, when it comes to the availability of communications. No other first world country in Asia would ration capacity the way that these companies do to us and charge us through the nose. It's astonishing.
But I guess people don't know what they're missing, right? That's the problem here. It's like the healthcare argument, that people, go to take bus trips to Canada to get cheap drugs and stuff.
Right. But there was a big front page article in the New York Times about somebody going to Brussels to get a hip replacement this past weekend. Same thing, right, because we look like a third world country in comparison to particularly Korea and Japan when it comes to both their wired and cellular data services. And because so few Americans have been to South Korea and Japan, they have no idea what they're missing. And many developed nations have much more fiber in place than we do. Japan, Korea, Sweden, Estonia, Norway, Iceland, Denmark, Portugal, Hungary, Turkey. I mean, there's just endless numbers of countries. And yet, because Americans believe that we're always in the lead, we find it difficult to accept that other countries have overtaken us by far.
But wouldn't, if you were wired in this way, and there's a lot of fiber optics that are being laid in any case, but if we were all connected with fiber optics like they are in Japan and South Korea and other countries you just mentioned, wouldn't that add enormously to the country's productive capacity? It would improve hospitals enormously, education enormously. Just off the top of my head, I can imagine the difference. And rather than sitting around waiting for stuff to, staring at your screen, everything happens instantly.
That's right. And not only download, the upload, because the whole thing about fiber is that it has equal upload to download. But upload speeds now available to consumers here in America are at rates 10 to 50 times slower than download speeds. And that means that all the things we'd like to be doing in terms of online backup, publishing our own materials, participating in an online class, visiting a doctor over telemedicine connections, all of that is becoming possible in other countries and not possible here. So that puts us dramatically behind as a nation, and also means that the new things that are going to be developed in those countries won't come from America. And that's terrible for our global standing and our productivity. The first generation of Internet inventions all came from America. We took the lead, but now we really are in the dust. So we're subject to a gigantic digital divide internally between the poor and the more affluent. And we're also subject to a digital divide between the United States and other countries, and we seem to be blissfully unaware of it.
And meanwhile, the corporations who monopolize what we do get and don't want to provide us what we could have are making enormous amounts of money, pretending to compete, but they aren't really competing. And I suppose, just in closing, the silver lining in this current cloud, because I'm personally furious that I'm paying for something that I can't get, and two corporations are playing their kind of corporate macho games at my expense, and there's nothing I can do about it. It's just as infuriating. But you think that this may have a silver lining in as much as it may wake up the American people to exactly how much they're getting shafted and how important the control of information is, and how this is what happens when monopolies control information.
Yes, I do, but the problem is it takes a few sentences to explain. So I hope that we get an opportunity to say, look, it feels like this is just about TV programming, but actually that one wire to your home is a great big digital pipe, and there's a single provider who's controlling everything that's flowing towards you and can charge whatever it wants for it and can pick and choose among programs. So what we're seeing is the cablization of the Internet, and it's real control by a very few actors here in America, and it's a great concern.
Well, Susan Crawford, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Again, I've been speaking with Susan Crawford, who's a professor of law at the Benjamin Cardoza School of Law at Yeshiva University and a regular contributor to Bloomberg View and Wired. She served as special assistant to President Obama for science, technology, and innovation policy and co-led the FCC transition team between the Bush and Obama administrations. Susan Crawford is a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, where she leads the Institute's work on making high-speed Internet access a universal, affordable resource for all, and she's a member of Mayor Michael Bloomberg's Advisory Council on Technology and Innovation. Professor Crawford has been a visiting professor at Harvard, Yale, and the University of Michigan, and her latest book is Captive Audience, The Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking about how Al-Qaeda is actually moving into Iraq.
Television rules the nation. Television rules the nation. Television rules the nation.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Peter Van Buren, who's a 24-year veteran Foreign Service officer at the State Department, who spent a year in Iraq leading two State Department provincial reconstruction teams. He wrote about it in We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. Following his book, the Department of State began termination proceedings against him, stripping him of his security clearance and diplomatic credentials. Through the efforts of the Government Accountability Project and the ACLU, he instead retired from the State Department with full benefits. He has an article at Salon, Welcome to Post-Constitutional America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Van Buren.
Pleasure to be here, Ian. Thank you for having me.
And it strikes me as an enormous irony that one of the lies the Bush-Cheney administration sold us to get into the Iraq war was their claim that Al-Qaeda was setting up a base in Iraq. And now it's becoming a grim truth as Al-Qaeda in Iraq's Sunni resurgence against Maliki's corrupt and sectarian government gains momentum.
One of the things that has been clearer and clearer as time has gone by is that the disastrous mistakes in Iraq cannot be confined within the borders of Iraq. We're seeing now the most obvious signs of what many people have been observing over the years, that Al-Qaeda has found a home where they once were not even particularly welcome, and that homeland in Iraq is allowing them to influence events in Syria and beyond. The mistakes of 2003 seem to never stop.
And in terms of Al-Qaeda asserting itself, there were about over 800 Al-Qaeda operatives sprung from Abu Ghraib prison recently in a very cleverly designed attack. Several of them were leaders scheduled for execution. So they're joining a resurgence that's happening. And my understanding is that the Sunni minority, who lost power due to the Bush-Cheney intervention, and who traditionally, or at least for the longest time, ruled Iraq, they've always been sort of surly and dejected and despondent. And Maliki sort of more recently has gone after them. And that's made them even more feeling more marginalized and outraged. And I take it that al-Qaeda in Iraq is tapping into that reservoir of outrage.
Absolutely. This is the story of the surge and the failure of the surge. What we saw is that after the Sunnis lost power after the American invasion and the Shias rose to prominence, the Sunni people were marginalized. They were often pushed aside, if not outright subject to violence by the new government. And they were looking for someone to protect them. Al-Qaeda, to the extent that we can use that word to describe an amorphous organization, I mean, Al-Qaeda is probably more of a concept or an idea than it is a particular organization that has a building someplace with a plaque on the wall or something like that. Al-Qaeda emerged as their protector and established itself quite effectively in Iraq. The United States attempted to drive a wedge between al-Qaeda, the foreign element, and the Sunnis in Iraq, and that's what we call the surge. It was designed to solve the problem that we had created when we kicked over the anthill in Iraq, the Sunni-Shia divide. It did not solve that problem. It had, at best, put it on hold, if you will. Basically, if you put enough American soldiers in between two groups, those two groups are going to be unable to struggle with each other. And that's what the surge really was. And as soon as we removed the troops, things started to fall apart. Let's not forget that Prime Minister Maliki, first of all, went into office only because he had the support of the Iranians. And more importantly, within days of the American army's withdrawal, he put out an arrest warrant for his Sunni vice president. I think the message was very clear.
And he, of course, has shown his fealty towards Iran. The United States government has begged him to stop Iranian overflights to resupply the Assad regime in Syria, and he's basically given the back of his hand. Is there, as the situation deteriorates in the Sunni area and as the country fragments more along the civil war outlines that we saw in the mid-2000s, is it possible that Maliki will ask the Americans to come back and referee the country again?
It's difficult to imagine why he would do that. It's possible to imagine that he might allow a few American organizations in as kind of a political tool. He wants money, he wants weapons, he wants what he can get from the Americans, and the price may be to allow small special forces groups or some CIA operation or something that is small and controllable and something he can keep a close eye on. But in terms of actually establishing a more comprehensive relationship with the United States, I don't quite see where his interest in that would be. He has a very powerful ally in Iran that has served him well, and he has served them well. The Sunnis are a problem for him, and he seems to have chosen a violent and politically divisive strategy to deal with them. I'm not quite sure where America would fit in the middle of all that. Our strategy in the Middle East appears to be to continually inject weapons and violence into every situation, as if the last 12 years have not shown us that strategy, and of course I'm referring to Libya as much as anything, has simply not worked. Maliki, I think, is sitting very pretty and certainly doesn't need the United States. He may find the United States helpful in some small ways, but overall, I think the war was lost, and Maliki knows he was the winner.
And, well, Iran was the winner.
Well, of course, I mean, in the broader sense, the Iran was clearly the winner of the U.S.-Iraq war. Iran, in 2003, watched the United States watched the United States clear the Taliban off of its eastern border. And the Taliban and the Iranians were certainly no friends of one another. And then in 2003, the United States cleared the Sunnis off of their western border. I think Iran probably sent George Bush a birthday card that year, thanking him for his service to the Ayatollahs. At the same time, Iran has benefited remarkably from the new Iraq. You mentioned the overflights, the smuggled weapons into Syria. Iraq has also been a very valuable partner in helping Iran sidestep U.S. sanctions. Enormous amounts of money and goods flow across the Iranian-Iraqi border. Iran is able to move its oil out that way. It's able to change currency and do its business that way. It's been quite a good run for the Iranians as far as this is concerned. And Maliki has gotten his share of the profits, if you will, as well. In particular, the Iranians helped him get his seat in the 2010 elections and continue to support him and continue to support him in his struggle against the Sunnis. So again, America is really not a player in any of this in any significant way. And the Iranians and the Iraqis really have no interest in changing the status quo right now.
Again, I'm speaking with Peter Van Buren, who's a 24-year veteran Foreign Service officer at the State Department, who spent a year in Iraq leading two State Department provincial reconstruction teams. He wrote about it in We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. Following his book, the Department of State began termination proceedings against him, stripping him of his security clearance and diplomatic credentials. Through the efforts of the Government Accountability Project and the ACLU, he instead retired from the State Department with full benefits. He has an article at Salon, Welcome to Post-Constitutional America. But obviously, what's been unleashed now and this growing Sunni sectarian divide in this, particularly with this proxy war going on in Syria, I think is bound to bring in more and more regional players and expand. And the most logical place for it to expand, which it already has, is across the Syrian-Iraqi border. How do you foresee a future here? Because either the war will go on forever, or not forever, but for a long time, or as Assad recently said, that he's winning militarily. So what would seems to me the consequences either way, whether Assad wins or loses, are going to be bad for Iraq's cohesion.
Absolutely. I think the easiest way to look at this is that there will be increasing violence across the Middle East, and in particular on the Syria-Iraq border. It's worth taking a deep breath and trying to sort these players out for a moment. The so-called rebels that are in Syria that are being supported by the United States are part and parcel with al-Qaeda. America, for public consumption, tries to pretend that we hand weapons to one rebel because he's not al-Qaeda, but we don't hand them to the guy next to him because he, quote, is al-Qaeda, as if we could possibly even know those things or possibly control them. So we're supplying weapons to the al-Qaeda side in Syria. Meanwhile, we are trying to get Maliki to allow us to intercede in his battle with the al-Qaeda people in Iraq, while Tehran supports Maliki and, reaching over the top of all this, supports Assad. So if that doesn't confuse your listeners, then they're better men and women than I am. The lesson here is very straightforward, and that is the boundaries in the Middle East are not lines on a map that make sense to anyone other than the British cartographers who drew them after World War I. The borders in the Middle East are based on religious connections, tribal connections, military-type alliances, if you will. And when the United States continues to think it is clever enough to muddle in these things, the results have been tragically repeated over and over and over again. As we talked earlier, the war in 2003 kicked over an anthill, disturbed a status quo that had held Iraq together for many years. The United States failed to replace that status quo with anything and simply walked away from it, hoping that that would be that. Instead, the problem has popped its head up again in Syria, where America continues to pour weapons in hopes of some type of a solution, without even really taking a moment to realize we're supporting the people in Syria that we're not supporting on the other side of the border in Iraq, which are threatening our embassies across the Middle East and so on and so forth. If you don't understand the rules, you probably shouldn't be playing. It's like the old saying, if you're not sure who the patsy is at the poker table, it's you.
Well, you know, it's pretty amazing to think that Bush Sr. never talked to his son, because I know Brent Scowcroft, and he was one of the few people that tried to warn them against this ridiculous war. And he knew at the time of Bush Sr.'s first Iraq war that you couldn't go into Baghdad and you'd be fighting a guerrilla war, and which is exactly what happened when the Sun and the neocons and Cheney, pushing it more than anybody, came up with this ridiculous idea. And I think in many ways they used they conned the kid into getting into this war based upon the sort of notion that he was going to clean up his father's mess. You know, his father should have gone into Baghdad, and this time Junior's going to show Dad. Boy, what a catastrophe it's turned out to be.
You wish that the lessons of history might be learned by someone, but again, I have to look back at the current administration's intercession in Libya, where, again, there was a relative status quo. The United States had, for whatever reason, reopened diplomatic relations with Gaddafi, and yet we kicked over another anthill without really understanding the complexity of relations inside of Libya, the interplay between the different groups that had simmered under Gaddafi's central control. And then we essentially walked away from it. We're left with a chaotic situation there that pops its head up every once in a while, and with a Benghazi-like incident. The weapons that were cut loose in Libya have found their way into other parts of northern Africa and fueled the trouble in Mali. It appears that the United States was using some of those weapons, smuggling them out of Libya through Turkey into Syria in kind of a mini Iran-Contra scandal, if you will. These things are complex systems. They are very complex problems. And simply, crudely, walking in and declaring a dictator gone and hoping that democracy sprouts up in the desert somehow is just foolish. And we've seen now two administrations in a row commit these same errors. I wish they would read last week's newspapers before they take next week's actions.
So just in the last couple of minutes then, Peter Van Buren, the only part, and we haven't talked about this, the only part of Iraq that seems to work is the Kurdish part, and it works largely because they're completely autonomous, right?
Absolutely, and the Kurds have sort of fallen off everyone's screen, but it's very important to remember that there were three distinct groups in Iraq, the Shias, the Sunnis, and the Kurds. Kurdistan, the northern, what used to be northern Iraq, is an independent nation in every single sense of the word, except perhaps a sign on the desk at the United Nations. Kurdistan has its own military, it has its own currency, it has its own government, it elects its own officials. It signs contracts and negotiates with corporations and companies. It's the only part of Iraq that is finding prosperity and figuring out how to monetize its oil. And it no longer is a part of Iraq in any realistic sense. The problem, of course, with Kurdistan is that its borders are not the black lines on the map. What Kurds believe Kurdistan is extends into Iran and into Turkey. The war between the Kurds and the Turks has been on low simmer for quite some time. And that, too, will have to find its own solution, its violent end, given that the United States has taken the cap off of it and then left the Kurds and the Turks and the Iranians to sort things out on their own. Right now it's quiet, and the Turks and the Kurds have taken a summer off, apparently. But that violent situation will find its resolution as well, even as the Sunnis and Shias continue theirs.
Well, and Iraq's oil, which you're supposed to, remember they told us that the Iraq war would be paid for by the oil that would flow in copious quantities. My understanding is that the oil has not been particularly developed, and that you mentioned earlier that that Iran, that's under embargo, is selling its oil through Iraq, which is going on. So, at least the notion that a lot of people had, and even Alan Greenspan said this war is all about oil. If that was what it was about, that was another incredible piece of incompetence on the part of the Bush-Cheney administration. If they were if they were going there to bring democracy and to grab the oil, it looks like they're wrong on both counts.
The Iraq literally floats on oil. The oil in Iraq is closer to the surface than practically anywhere else in the world, and there are incredible quantities of it under the ground. The problem is there's a difference between oil in the ground and oil that can make its way to international markets. Iraq, the infrastructure of Iraq was circa 1963 and basically hasn't been tidied up, maintained, or improved ever since then. In addition, Iraq lacks the electrical capacity to do what you need to do to get oil out of the ground. Iraq has a single port to the world, which is crowded with ships bringing food in to try to keep the population from starving to death after the United States destroyed so much during the invasion, and that port doesn't have any more room in it to move oil out. In addition, the security situation is so horrendous that international companies are reluctant to make significant investments, and whenever things do start to get built, they're very easily torn down or destroyed by the bad guys, if you will. Finally, oil is a national resource, and Iraq lacks a government that represents the nation. And so there's infighting and pushing and shoving over whose money it is and whose oil it is. The last thing, of course, that was not thought about was that you need a lot of water to extract oil. Basically, we all know that water and oil don't mix, and so you pump clean water in, not salt water, clean water in to force the oil out. And Iraq lacks the ability to desalinate enough water and has no fresh water sources that are significant enough to do the job. And all these things were left out of the equation. I suspect if we got Dick Cheney drunk in a bar one night, what he would have said is, well, after we finish the war, Halliburton was going to go in there and make another $1 trillion providing all that for the Iraqis. But that's a pretty lame excuse at this late date. The war started 10 years ago, and Iraq is producing less oil now than it did before the war.
Well, Peter Van Buren, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Peter Van Buren, who's a 24-year veteran Foreign Service officer at the State Department, who spent a year in Iraq leading two State Department provincial reconstruction teams. He wrote about it in We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. Following his book, the Department of State began termination proceedings against him, stripping him of his security clearance and diplomatic credentials. And through the efforts of the Government Accountability Project and the ACLU, he instead retired from the State Department with full benefits. He has an article at Salon, Welcome to Post-Constitutional America. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the suspension today of 13 baseball players, including three-time American League MVP Alex Rodriguez. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Gary Wadler, who is a physician and expert on the subject of drug use in sports. He currently serves as the chairman of the World Anti-Doping Agency's Prohibited List and Methods Subcommittee, and has served as a medical advisor to the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. He's the author of Drugs and the Athlete. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gary Wadler.
Nice being with you.
And today's suspension of 13 baseball players, including the three-time American League MVP Alex Rodriguez, of course, is very much the headlines. Rodriguez has been sidelined for 211 games throughout the 2014 season. But it also strikes me that this is a problem that won't go away. So why is it that we keep hearing about this problem continually?
Well, it's not growing, which is a good thing, but it's not disappearing. That's not such a good thing. But there are many aspects of the effects of steroids, particularly on athletic performance, which makes it attractive to those who want to take every advantage they can, better known as cheating. It's a dangerous habit, and we are concerned that it's reaching down into the young people in the high schools, and it's a serious problem.
So is it at the point now, if you're a young aspiring baseball player and your own personal athleticism reaches a certain level and you basically are faced with a choice that if you want to up your game, you have to take what they call the juice. Is it that stark?
Well, I don't think it's that bad. There are those who will violate the rules of the game and take these substances, and not only steroids, but a whole array of performance-enhancing substances to enhance their value And ultimately, it gets back to if you're in the professional ranks, to contracts and how much money you can generate by increasing your performance. So, it's when money's out there, it does a lot of things to a lot of people's way of thinking. And there's no question that I've often said the five-letter word which encompasses this whole thing. It's money, money. The seller makes money by selling the stuff. The user makes money by increasing his performance and increasing his value with contract time. And when that duo of or the interplay between performance and I lost my thought on that one.
Well, tell us about these companies that are caught up in these, you know, recurring scandals, Dr. Gary Wadler. Now, in this particular one, we got Biogenesis, which is an anti-aging clinic in Miami that's under scrutiny for you know, peddling in performance-enhancing drugs. This seller they called A-Rod, Alex Rodriguez, had a relationship with this company. I recall that back Mark McGuire, I think it was, who was a champion hitter there for a while. He was involved with a company in San Francisco. I think it was called Balco.
Correct.
So it feels again like deja vu again. So what are the relationship between these athletes and these companies, and who?
Well, these companies realize, again, getting back to the subject of money, that a lot of money to be made, and so the sales pitch plays to that factor. And so, whether it's Balco or any of the other ones, there's a built-in audience out there, and they're basically elite athletes who are trying to up their game.
But this is an international problem, right? I mean, it's not just baseball.
Oh, no, it's clearly international, and there has been. The Olympic movement for years was plagued by this. It's not just an American phenomenon by any stretch of the imagination. You know, you might ask why athletes are taking anabolic steroids. They increase their lean body mass, they increase their strength, they increase their muscle definition, increase their aggressiveness, increase their acceleration, and improve their recovery times. And so there's many facets associated with the use of anabolic steroids which are perceived by the athlete to be worth taking the risk. And obviously we don't condone that.
But isn't that true in nature? There's no free ride. In other words, all of those things that you said that must be very attractive to an athlete, that improves all aspects of performance, isn't there a downside that the body eventually pays the price?
Well, they have a sense of, athletes have a sense of invincibility. You know, it's sort of like a soldier. They're never going to be the ones that are going to get shot. They're not going to be the ones that get caught. And so they're of the mind that if they follow the rules of a guru, and I use that word very specifically, the gurus tell them what to take, and they go take it. And the people who are selling the product have a willing victim to buy their product, whether it comes from Balco or comes from Biogenesis. The other thing that's going on, of course, which is away from sports, is the anti-aging clinics that have blocked them over the last few years.
Right. Well, your line is cracking up. I'm afraid we may have to call you right back immediately. I'm sorry. Can you? Well, just say hello to me again. Maybe it stopped, but it was really bad.
I'll say it again.
No. It's bad. It's bad. We're going to call you right back, okay?
Thanks.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Gary Wadler, who's a physician and expert on the subject of drug use in sports. He currently serves as the chairman of the World Anti-Doping Agency's Prohibited List and Methods Subcommittee and has served as a medical advisor to the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy, and he's the author of Drugs and the Athlete. So I'm interested, though, when you mentioned a minute ago what these drugs do for the athlete's body and how they enhance his performance in every possible aspect, and it makes it clear to me that they must be irresistible to a lot of to athletes. Give us a sense of the downside. What does the long term use of steroids do to the human body? Because I understand, you know, it almost changes the whole physical nature.
Well, it changes the body in a variety of ways, and first of all, there are those changes in the body which are sex organ related, influenced by testosterone. There are effects on the cardiovascular system, hypertension, for example. There, in teenagers, it stunts their growth. The cholesterol, which I think I mentioned, there's a whole array of adverse effects, some of which are predictable, some are not predictable, some are permanent, some are not permanent, some are physical as opposed to psychiatric. We're all familiar with the issue of roid rage. There's more than enough to go around in terms of the side effects, the dependency, so that they, like other forms of dependency, they would like to give up using the steroids, but they can't. And then, of course, there's the psychiatric side effects, whether it's increased aggressiveness or whether it's roid rage. Nowadays, it used to be difficult to administer this stuff because it was taken by particularly dangerous steroids. Now they use patches and creams. You see these things advertised on television all the time, so it's easier to administer, which makes it more attractive, which makes it particularly worrisome. So there's a whole host of these things that have adverse effects. But, again, they have a sense of invincibility. They're not the one who's going to get those adverse effects. The other thing I was about to say when we had the telephone problem was the issue of human growth hormone, which has become an increasingly big problem and a dangerous problem. These clinics, which are mushrooming all over the place, as agents where you can get the fountain of youth. And so now you have people taking combinations of anabolic steroids, such as testosterone, with human growth hormones. So it gets fairly complicated and increasingly dangerous to play that kind of a game. But again, it's all about money. And again, in the pros, and you can up your game substantially. Unfortunately, there are people who can take advantage of that attitude.
Well, it would seem, though, Dr. Gary Wadler, that you mentioned this new rash of anti-aging clinics, and of course the one under scrutiny now is Biogenesis in Miami. So they sell them, so that they're getting customers who are just regular folks who are not just athletes wanting to up their game.
Absolutely. That's why they call it the Fountain of Youth. It's promoted not as an athletic hormone, but as one that will convey your youthfulness about you. And you're absolutely right. It's not limited to athletes.
So you would think that given the dangers of what these drugs can do, that how come these companies like Biogenesis can put up a shingle and get a bunch of people in and legally give them steroids and growth hormones?
The interesting word you used is legally. I'm not so sure that the federal law as it relates to human growth hormone makes it legal to use it for anti-aging purposes. The approved uses are the treatment of children who are unusually short-statured, or for people who have deficiency in human growth hormone that's documented by medical testing, or individuals with the inner stages of AIDS. Those are the only approved indications. So anti-aging is not. For whatever reason, the government has not chosen to pursue that. But my reading of the law is that it is illegal to use it for the purposes of anti-aging.
And clearly, it's not illegal for athletes to use it, but it does cost them their careers, or at least they get suspended.
It is illegal. If you follow the law, it is illegal, but it can affect their careers for sure.
Right. But the real sanction against its use is what's just happening to these 13 players, right? They get suspended, although most of them have been suspended for 50 games, with the exception of Alex Rodriguez.
Yeah.
Who's out through the 2014 season. So, tell me about what you do on the national the World Anti-Doping Agency's prohibitive list and methods. What's that about?
That is a group of individuals from all over the world who have diverse backgrounds. That can be research scientists, physicians, pharmacologists, pharmacists. And we, on an annual basis, update the list of those substances which are not approved for use in sport. They may be legal as a substance that can be used medically, but in sport it's illegal. And that list is annually reviewed and approved by the World Anti-Doping Agency. So it's to make sure that we are keeping current, and it's a very, very worthwhile initiative that has helped us take a giant step forward in anti-doping.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Dr. Gary Wadler, again, physician and expert on the subject of drug use in sport. He currently serves as the chairman of the World Anti-Doping Agency's Prohibitive List and Methods Subcommittee and served as a medical advisor to the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy, and he's the author of Drugs and the Athlete. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.